Okay, then I'll start.
Okay.
We're covering chapter 13 of Tragedy and Hope, and it really, it just follows on from chapter 12. It's all got to do with the time, the decade more or less, before World War II. And, in chapter 12, it's called the appeasement, circles, and counter-circles, and how the various states of Europe and their alliances are trying to position themselves, each trying to find a favorable outcome for each other. What we learned in the previous chapter was that the Round Table Group, the English Anglo-American establishment, as it's called, with its inner circles, were wanting to maneuver the countries in Europe to set up a three-block world order. They wanted to set up a state in Central Europe to dominate Europe, to act as a buffer between the Atlantic board, which would consist of the Americas and Britain, and then Germany would buffer the West from the East, from the Soviets, from communism. And then in turn, Japan would act as a buffer on the other side of Russia. What we've learned from the earlier chapters in the book is that the round table groups have set up, through the Royal Institute of International Affairs, they set up the various Council of Foreign Relations around the world, or the Royal Institutes, which are in the Commonwealth countries, and also a Pacific bloc as well. So already we've had those, we've got three blocks, and we know that what we've learned now through chapter 13 is that three block system it's been planned, very specifically. And all of this appeasement, it wasn't just, as people might think, countries purely trying to think of their own, interests and money, etc. I'm sure that within those countries, people who weren't in the know might have thought that, but they were being manipulated and managed by higher circles. Another thing that reading Tragedy and Hope shows you, as quickly did talk about circles within circles, that you can definitely see it in action throughout the book. What is a common theme in this chapter is it's a 7-point plan which the inner group of Britain wanted to achieve for Europe, for Germany. And I'll just go through those 7 points because they are key to understanding the whole book up to this stage, particularly chapter 13. So the first point was that they wanted Germany to be the bulwark against communism. The second point is that they wanted to create a four-power pact of France, Great Britain, Italy, and Germany, to the exclusion of Russia. They didn't want Russian influence in Europe. Third point, they were not at all opposed to German acquiring its colonial goals, to take Austria, Czechoslovakia, and the Danzig, that Polish corridor. Fourth point, Germany must not use force, as Britain would then have to intervene due to public pressure. And this point, this do not use force, plays out very, very strongly with this inner group. And they used the excuse that they played on that to push appeasement to incredible lengths, blindsiding their own domestic population. The fact that people don't hate Britain more than they do is amazing. The fifth point is Britain wanted Germany to agree to restrict its number of warplanes. I suppose they didn't want Germany to run away with it. So they did want Germany to be a powerhouse, but they didn't obviously want Germany to succeed too far. In other words, to succeed against Russia or to succeed against themselves possibly. The sixth point, Britain prepared to give Germany colonial lands if it would ensure its claim, if it would give up its claim to Tanganyika. I think that's Tanzania. 7, Britain would use pressure on Czechoslovakia and Poland to negotiate with Germany and to be conciliatory to Germany's desires. And then there was an 8th point which came up later in the book, which was the realization that the German government, the Nazi government, was broke and needed economic support. And if the general public of Britain knew about these things, they could never have pulled this, any of this off. So the British establishment are guilty, in a sense, of high treason. It's quite disgusting what they got away with. Okay, so bearing in mind those 7 points, then I'll start with the beginning. So it's titled Austria in Felix, the period from 1933 to 1938. And in Felix, it's a word for misery or sadness. So just a bit of background about Austria is that after the Treaty of Saint-Germain, Austria was completely run down. Its population had dropped from 52 million to only 6.6 million. So its economy was on the rocks almost. It used to be part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. It was really reduced to one main city-state or city called Vienna. And the rest of the countryside was more or less very sparsely populated. What we learn is that there was an enormous gulf in the outlook between the people of the city, between Vienna, and the people who occupied the rural areas. The city was socialist, democratic, anti-clerical, was pacifist, and progressive, while the country was Catholic, ignorant, intolerant, belligerent, and backwards. Between the city, the city was run by the Social Democrats, and the country was run by the Christian Socialists. It gets a little bit complicated later in the book, because I think quickly sometimes swaps the wording around a little bit. The outlying areas were also made up of minor groups like the Agrarian League and the Pan-Germans, who typically joined forces with the Christian Socialists. So what you had was a split between the government of the city and the federal government of the Christian Socialists. So page 609. In 1921, we find out that the Pan-Germans joined with a member of the Pan-Germans, Christian, what's his name here, Johann Schober. When the Pan-Germans joined up with Christian Socialists, he took power there in that party. It changed hands again under a guy named Ignaz Seipel. He was a monsignor. He was, what's the word? I don't know what the word is, but he was given that designation by the Pope. And I read later in on Wikipedia that he lost that designation. And he was in power from 1922 to 1932. Later on, we find his role was taken over by Engelbert Dollfuss and Schuschnigg. And if you've looked up Dollfuss, you'll notice that he's a runty little man with a one big eye and one small eye, just a nasty-looking guy. A little, he's got the face that I personally would like to slap. 1918 to 1933, page 608, 609, we read, during this time period, the social Dems, that is, the city, embarked on a program of social welfare. They raised the standards of living exponentially. They taxed the wealthy and lowered housing costs. And when we read up about how people were living in Austria, it was absolutely tragic. Tiny little apartments, no running water, just shocking. And the Social Democrats really took the country into a far higher standard of living and made things a lot more fair. And I've got a, I made a little note. I think that, you know, there's a whole lot more going on behind the scenes that Quigley simply can't insert into his book. So I'd say that the roundtable groups across Europe were already having their influence on parties like the Social Dems. You know, they were taking their cues. I'm pretty sure they would have been taking their cues from the roundtable groups. Simultaneously, the federal government was sinking into corruption. They were stealing public funds, funneling them to banks and industry, which led to a parliamentary investigation in the country, of which they were found to be guilty. The Christian Democrats undertook to investigate it, and they were found to be guilty nonetheless. And this led to the popularity of the Social Democrats being increased. So later on, 1927, SAPL, or Monsignor SAPL, formed in terms, he called it a unity list of anti-social Dems, of groups that were anti-social against the Social Democrats, but it was not enough. So we see how the divide came into existence and how it was exacerbated. So throughout the German-speaking spheres, the Lebensraum, the unfairness of the treaty against Germany, the greater German-speaking region was slowly being coerced into backing an aggressive German state and not so much seeking to, but acquiescing to the German state seeking to absorb the greater speaking German groups in Europe. Then we learn SAPL sought to change the constitution to a presidential dictatorship. So here we go. We've seen this in modern times as well. It always goes in this direction. And perhaps during that time, they would have used the term resisting internationalism, perhaps, resisting international communism, perhaps. In order for the constitution to change, they needed to acquire 2/3 of the vote in parliament. We find out that that was unsuccessful. So SAPL, the good Christian that he was, resorted to encouraging the growth of the Heimwehr, or the Heimwehr, home guard, as it is in English, traditionally from the rural areas of Austria to defend the frontiers. And he set them up or encouraged them as a reactionary militia. Then in 1929, SAPL's plans, they failed outright. And so he resorted to illegal methods carried out by Engelbert Dollfuss. Page 610, we learn that
Well, I just wanted to, before we got too far in advance, I wanted to interject something, if I may, here. I there is a point here on page 609 where Quigley is comparing what the Social Democrats did for the city of Vienna by raising the standard of living and so forth to the poverty that was going on in Berlin. So he said that the poor of Vienna spent only a fraction of their income for rent, less than 3%, compared to those in Berlin who had to spend 25% of their income. And before the war, 20% in Vienna. So in other words, this little experiment was short-lived under the Social Democrats. But when you think about, I didn't have time to look into the Social Democrats and really how they got their stronghold for that brief window. But it was clear that Britain had other plans, and Britain backs duplicitously Germany in a whole variety of ways. But I thought that just taking a look at what the Social Democrats had done in that little window of time, they took them. Some of those apartments were so bad they had no outside looking windows. They had no windows with light coming in. And so they went on this, extravagant building project, and the average rent was less than $2 a month. And that's astonishing, but I looked up what that dollar amount was in Australian dollars today, and it's $117. And if that represented 3% of their income, that would mean that their wages in 2024 dollars were averaging $3,900 per month. That was the poor of the city. So whatever experiment was happening there, the powers that be didn't want that, because later we're shown that Hitler had all these great ideas for improving the standard of living for the Germans, and a lot of that was PR.
And as it highlights, what the Social Democrats were doing was very bad optics for the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
It would have, if they had been allowed to follow through, the Nazi Party could well have lost its mm-hmm. momentum. Yeah. Yeah.
But the corruption of the Christian socialists was staggering. I mean, you're getting into that now, and I'll let you go, but just staggering.
Okay, dokes. Page 610. The leaders of the Heimwehr factions, they were joined by a rabid Nazi from Germany, and his name was Waldemar Pabst. And he was a Nazi who murdered his way through Germany, and he was expelled, but he was sort of put into Austria by the German Nazis to get things going. Yeah, the morals of these people, the nature of these people, the Social Democrats, they also had a militia, by the way, not a Melissa, but a militia, called the Schutzbund. I won't say that again. It's so Seipel, he constantly made use of the Heimswehr to pressurize the Social Dems. That's what we get throughout this chapter. In September 1930, Seipel formed a presidential cabinet of Christian Socialists and the Heimwehr combined. Members of the Heimwehr, remember, they're just a militia. They're not qualified bureaucrats or anything. They were given high public office. And slowly you can see a one-party state coming into being. The Christian Socialists suffered a setback in the elections of 1930. They recovered again under the violent campaigning of Dollfuss and Kurt Schuschnigg. They began ignoring democratic process and enforcing their rule through continuous violence, targeting the various social democratic institutions. I'm jumping to page 612. Dollfuss ruled by decree, and he made use of an expired or outdated old Habsburg Empire law, which was a law to be used during an economic emergency or crisis. He tried to apply the law, but it didn't work, but it didn't matter. They were so aggressive. They just did what they wanted to. They just pushed. So he used the law to put an end to meetings, to censor the press, suspend elections, create concentration camps, and also clamp down on the courts. And these measures were exclusively reserved or targeted the Social Democrats. In May 1933, Dollfuss failed to be elected as head of the Christian Socialists, just proving that I don't think even the Christian Socialists quite wanted somebody like him. That didn't stop him. He all bent out of shape. He and the Schuschnigg created the Fatherland Front, working tirelessly to complete, to get to a dictatorship. Followed by the Nazis, they began to attack him and the Heimswehr under orders from Germany. and they were also financed from Germany. So we got all these groups, and now we got the Nazis involved. So the Christian socialists are very, very right wing. But what we learn is that they typically are for the strict independence of Austria. And I think Hitler saw them as an obstacle towards an Anschluss. So the Nazis came in, and they started causing mayhem.
What interested me on that was that it was because of the Fatherland Front's desire to absorb any other competing political party. They took away all viability of parties and absorbed them into themselves, and they still couldn't get the upper hand. And what it left them with was two extremes, the Nazis and the communists, with no other party to adequately defend against them.
Yeah. Let's see. So yeah, these Nazis, they fought very, very dirty. They committed acts of terror, bombing and assassinations. And they technically banned tourism by imposing very, very heavy taxes on German tourists wanting to visit Austria. So they hit them where it hurt. Dollfuss attempted to, well, he actually did ban the Nazi party, but they, as you said, they went underground. By June 1933, they had succeeded in wounding Dollfuss. So they were really, they had their marching orders. All the while, Dollfuss still continued to attack the Social Dems. We learned that the Christian Socialists were supported by Mussolini. The Social Democrats were supported by France and Czechoslovakia. And that's another reason why they were so heavily attacked, because they stood in the way of boosting Germany, allowing Germany to become the dominant power. So I'm pretty sure behind the scenes, a group of people representing the roundtable groups were doing their thing at the same time, while the Nazis were there too. Page 614. So by February 1934, most of the leaders of the Schutzbund had also been arrested. By February the 15th, a coup took place, sealing the fate of the Social Dems of Vienna. All their institutions were declared illegal. April the 24th, 1934, a new constitution was declared under emergency economic decree, that Act of 1917 from the Habsburg Empire. An attempt was made to legitimize this new constitution. Again, they failed, but it didn't really matter. Anyway, they were now on a path of brute force. The banks, due to the depression, were taken over by the Fatherland Front. Positions in these institutions were given to what Quigley terms party hacks, replacing competent bureaucrats, most of them, or a lot of them, who were Jewish. Page 615. By 1934, corruption was completely endemic. It was who you knew that really mattered. In order to get an insight into the business world, you had to know people, and you had to pay them, you had to bribe them. And isn't that interesting? Because it's what's the difference between lobbying and bribing? So pure fascism came into being through this lobbying system. Carrying on, May to June 1934, the Nazis started resorting to extreme violence. They were bombing up to 15 bombings per day. that the Fatherland Front responded by threatening the death penalty. In turn, the Nazis threatened a push. I'm not quite sure how you say it, but it's a coup. A young socialist was framed and hung. Nazis were to attack the next day. On July the 25th, the Nazis rushed the Chancellery and murdered Dollfuss and locked themselves in. The response from Germany, let's see here, the Nazis were going to announce a new government. However, Mussolini, he stepped in, he threatened to invade if they did. So after a period of gridlock, the Nazis, who had locked themselves in, were deported. Nazi organizations were closed and activities suspended. When they had found that Dollfuss had been murdered, a number of these Nazis were executed. So Schuschnigg and the Heimwehr, they split the government between themselves 50-50. And they attempted by 1934 July to destroy. Okay, so here we go to the next degree of dictatorship. So between themselves, they were wanting to take the country to a purely personal dictatorship. So, you know, to do that, they had in their way the Christian Socialists Party, the Heimswehr Militia, and the Nazis. Page 616, they went about this by absorbing them into a one amorphous body, the Fatherland Front. They shammed and conned their way through this whole process, a lot like you'd expect from the British establishment. Forced them to join, forced them to obey. And this pressure led to two underground groups, as you've mentioned, the Nazis, the communists, with the Nazis having by far the higher numbers. Mussolini. Let's see here. Mussolini's failures in Ethiopia opened a gap for Schuschnigg to get rid of the Heimwehr. That's quite important. March 1936, the Rome Protocols were supplemented, and Austria copied Germany by decreeing general military service probably mandatory. I put in brackets, I said, where are we seeing this again? So aren't we seeing that being echoed throughout Europe at the moment? So in the process of this military service, they ended up alienating France and the little Entente, Romania, is it Romania? Is it Bulgaria? One other. Under pressure from Mussolini, Austria was forced to make peace with Hitler in 1936. And Austria admitted it was a German state through a Nazi sent from Germany. His name was Franz von Papen. And he was pressurizing the Austrians. Slowly but surely, Germany made gains through concessions to undermine Austrian sovereignty, to merge identity, though not necessarily openly stated all the time. Jumping to 618. So this assimilation was led by von Papen or Papen and the Austrian minister Arthur von Seyss-Inquart. March 12th, 1938, the annexation and invasion of Austria occurs. As stated by Quigley, it was a pleasant surprise and was expedited by two favorable circumstances. There was the international situation and there was the situation within Austria itself. 1937, going back a bit, the British and German government, we learn, had made secret agreements for Austria and Czechoslovakia. You see how it's planned. It's not organic. It doesn't just happen on the fly. In short, Britain agreed with Hitler that he could take Austria and Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain wanted to satisfy the colonial ambitions of Germany. Britain and France had written off the Czechs, the Czechoslovakians. Also Hitler, he knew that France could not afford to intervene without Britain's support. So as we go through the chapter, we get these data points from Quigley, but he doesn't necessarily connect them completely for us. Everyone, all of these parties to all these countries and all of their leaders and diplomats, etc., they at the top, or at least in high places, they could all work this out. But the public, the general publics of all of these countries are kept completely in the dark. So Hitler, we learn that Hitler completely, he acted diametrically opposed to the wishes of his generals. His eagerness to take Austria, to take Czechoslovakia, when his generals would have known that Czechoslovakia was immensely powerful, the most powerful country in Europe, militarily speaking, they couldn't believe what Hitler was wanting to do. And so they opposed him. But that just tells you that a whole lot of Anglo-American or round table establishment had been spending a whole lot of time chatting to Hitler, whispering in his ear. let's see. February the 4th, 1938, Hitler replaced those generals who opposed him. And they were willing to assassinate him if necessary. So these generals were replaced by Ribbentrop, who became the foreign minister. Hitler himself, he assumed Minister of War, the position of Minister of War and Commander-in-Chief. And let's see. Ribbentrop, I forget the relationship now, but there was a person named Dirksen. And I just made a note here. I've forgotten now, but I called it the Ribbentrop-Dirksen dichotomy. I wish I could remember it more fluently, but it just, once again, Dirksen was pretty high up, and yet Ribbentrop didn't pay him much attention.
I think that Dirksen was the ambassador that they sent to London.
Yes.
I think that.
Yeah, it was that. There was a little bit more to it, but it just is proof to me that there's an inner and outer circle. There are many circles. So I think this inner and outer circles, or degrees of knowledge, degrees need to know basis. The only known organized way of pulling that off is through an organization which we all know well, is Masonry. When you look into Masonry, you can see what it really is. It's a multi-leveled, multifaceted need to know basis of people that are ambitious, know when not to speak, and will do as they are told, when they are told, to get ahead. And of course, quickly, I don't know, does he ever mention Masonry in this book? I can't remember. But I think he did mention that a couple of members were Masons, but they don't get discussed at all. So we mustn't forget that an international brotherhood of obedient Masons of various levels of knowledge are operating behind the scenes here. It fills in really all the gaps. So the 7-point plan of a 3-block world was communicated to a fair number of people in Germany. Not all of the top brass understood it or knew it, but once again, the public were completely unaware of it. Just a few names. Those involved on the British side was Lord Halifax, Neville Chamberlain, Neville Henderson, Horace Wilson, Thomas Inskip, John Simon. I think there's a Samuel Hoare as well. Jumping to 621, I just wrote, long story short, Hitler knew these plans, but his personal ambitions took over as he was made to believe Britain was very weak. And that just speaks once again to how good Britain is at managing perceptions on a grand scale like that. And as we've seen so far in the book, Quigley is very, very impressed by that. So the Round Table group actually did want Hitler to fulfill his aims, but not through force. I keep saying that too. They conceded willingly to his demands. And I then added, it's more like they were setting him up, in my opinion. I really do think that they were setting him up. Hitler was not interested in the democratic processes of normal government. Britain downplayed its own readiness and overplayed the threat of Germany to its own public and to the larger world. The tactic was to say that if we appease Germany, then they won't attack us. This way, they could enable Germany to fulfill their 3-block plan. Very, very clever. It's genius. They get others to fulfill their plans. When they realized Hitler was not going to play ball, they hastened to rearm. This is page 623. Churchill government and Churchill, they were aware of all of this, and they knew what Germany's true capabilities were, that Germany statistically, technically, was not up to the task of militarily conquering Europe. But they played along with this, with the con of it. Page 624, in essence, and in fact, Britain and France gave Hitler tacit license to take Austria. In Austria, the Nazis were humiliated. Schuschnigg was ordered to see Hitler on February 1938, sorry. He was given a dressing down and told to reinstate all Nazi privileges in Austria. However, quickly notes that Schuschnigg was still wanting to resist it all. He wanted Austria to be independent. And then March 13th, Hitler annexed Austria. And that is where I left it on the Austrian misery. Melissa, would you like to take off with the Czechoslovakian crisis?
Okay. That is the period 1937 to 1938. I'll just read a little bit here so that you know what Czechoslovakia was at that time. The most prosperous, most democratic, most powerful, and best administered of the states which arose on the ruins of the Habsburg Empire. As created in 1919, this country was shaped like a tadpole. So it's got this kind of fat head thing. I think that's what Quigley ends up calling the rump. And then it was made up of four main portions. It goes down to a little tail above Romania. And they were from west to east, Bohemia, Moravia, Slovakia, and Ruthenia. And I don't know too much about Ruthenia, but it is said they were Eastern Slavs. They became stronger in the late medieval period, and I think that there's some ancestry, shared ancestry there with the Belarusians and Ukrainians. So it had a large population, and it gives the breakdown. How many were Germans? How many were Czechs? How many were Slovaks, Hungarians, Poles, and Ruthenians? And the largest number were Czechs, of course, but right after that were Germans. In general, these people lived on a higher level of education, culture, economic life, and progressiveness as we move from east to west, the Germans and Czechs being on a high level, while the Slovaks and Ruthenians were on a lower level. But Quigley basically talks about, out of two sides of his mouth, you know, the idea that the other countries in Europe looking on considered Czechoslovakia to be a monster because it was a creation following World War One, and also the fact that it was very well run and prosperous. The key thing here was the Sudeten Mountains and the large number of Germans in this region, and that Hitler really wanted that for himself. He wanted that for Germany, he wanted to fold that in. And let's see here, a little bit of a background on what happened. I mean, essentially, just to cut to the chase, Hitler wanted it. He wanted something that the Czechoslovakians didn't want because they were well-treated and they were prosperous. And it doesn't seem from reading this, at least I can't find, that there were any great numbers of even Germans in the, or heritage Germans in the Sudetenland who wanted to become part of Germany. It said there were Nazis there, however, in that region who were loud and vocal, and they wanted to join up with Hitler. Said among the Germans of the Sudetenland, only part were Nazis, but they were noisy, well-organized, and financed from Berlin. Their numbers grew steadily, especially after the Austrian Anschluss. The Nazi Party in Czechoslovakia was banned in 1934, but under Konrad Henlein merely changed its name to the Sudeten German Party. In 1937, the Prime Minister, and I believe his name is pronounced Milan Hoxha, offered to transfer all the Germans in the national administration to the Sudeten areas and to train others until the whole bureaucracy in these areas was German. But none of the suggestions were acceptable to Henlein, who was, remember, a Nazi. He wanted no concessions within Czechoslovakia. His desire was to destroy the Czechoslovakian state, and we'll see that that also was Hitler's desire. He couldn't admit this publicly, but he did admit it in letters to Hitler. So he is carrying on a kind of a phony negotiation on the one hand with Prime Minister Hoxha, and on the other, he's doing everything he can to help Hitler get in there and destroy and take the Sudetenland. It said, these concessions were a danger to the state because the fortified zone against Germany ran along the mountains and thus right through the Sudetenland. Every concession to the Sudetens thus weakened the country's ability to defend itself against attack. These two facts made all efforts to compromise with Henlein futile from the beginning and made the constant British pressure on the Czech government to give additional concessions worse than futile. It is worthy to note that no public demand was made by either Henlein or Germany to detach the Sudetenland from Czechoslovakia until after September 12, 1938, although influential persons in the British government were advocating this, both in public and private, for months before the date. So it goes on to tell you, I'm just going to read a little bit more because, frankly, I think it's the easiest way to understand something that's kind of difficult. It said the Czech strength rested on its army of approximately 33 divisions, an interesting number there, which was the best in Europe in quality, the excellent fortification system, and its alliances with France, the Soviet Union, and the Little Entente. The annexation of Austria surrendered Bohemia with German territory on three sides, but its position from a military point of view was still strong. A line drawn from Berlin to Vienna would pass by Prague, but the German army could not safely invade Bohemia across its weakly fortified southern frontier with Austria because of the danger of a Czech counterattack from its fortified base into Bavaria. Within 2 weeks of Hitler's annexation of Austria, Britain was moving. It was decided to put pressure on the Czechs to make concessions to the Germans. Why? So we have to ask ourselves, why did Britain want that? To encourage France and eventually Germany to do the same, to insist that Germany must not use force to reach a decision, but to have patience enough to allow negotiations to achieve the same result, to exclude Russia, although it was allied to Czechoslovakia, from the negotiations completely. All of this was justified by the arguments that Czechoslovakia in a war with Germany would be smashed immediately, that Russia was of no military value whatever and would not honor its alliance with the Czechs anyway, and that Germany would be satisfied if it obtained the Sudetenland and the Polish corridor. All these assumptions were very dubious, but they were assiduously propagated both in public and in private, and may at times even have convinced the speakers themselves. These arguments are running counter to what we know to be true. There is no indication that Czechoslovakia would have been smashed immediately, especially if it hadn't been given any kind of support because it was militarily strong.
Melissa?
So, yes?
Yeah, it's just that old, if you repeat a lie often enough, it becomes true. And it becomes true to people in fairly high positions, a little bit more often than we think. So an entire country with the most modern, powerful army in Europe was literally, through repetition and language, disabled. It's quite amazing.
It is, yeah. It's a good point. Page 627 and 628 in my book goes on to tell you about these negotiations, about the pressure on Czechoslovakia to concede, and the fear, especially in France, of war. In France, it said fear of war was rampant. Moreover, in France, so much because they disliked democracy and admired authoritarian reaction, which was true, as because they were convinced that the defeat of Hitler would expose all of Central and perhaps Western Europe to Bolshevism and chaos. And the slogan of these people was "Better Hitler than Blum." This became increasingly prevalent in the course of 1938. And although nothing quite like this was heard in Britain, the idea behind it was not absent from that country. In this dilemma, the three-block world of the Cliveden set, and what we're really talking about here is the Chatham House, the Round Table group. And I think that the reason why the cry "Better Hitler than Blum" was not heard so much in Britain is because that really wasn't in the ruling elite, the Cliveden set, mind. They were firmly behind the three-block concept, and a fear of Bolshevism that didn't seem to be the motivating force for them. So it said, in this dilemma, the three-block world of the Kleibniz set, or even the German-Soviet war of the anti-Bolsheviks, seemed to be the only solution, because both required the elimination of Czechoslovakia from the European power system. Czechoslovakia was eliminated with the help of German aggression, French indecision and war weariness, and British public appeasement and merciless secret pressure. And that is an important part there on for considering Britain, because the secret maneuvering and machinations they did were quite astonishing. But he cuts to the chase here on, he said there's no need to get into the whole long, lengthy negotiations that occurred between Henlein and the Czech government. And that was, remember that Hoxhall, I think is how you say his name. It said, plan after plan for minority rights, economic concessions, cultural and administrative autonomy, and even political federalism were produced by the Czechs, submitted to Britain and Germany, and eventually brushed aside as inadequate by Henlein. The latter's Carlsbad demands were enunciated April 24th after Henlein's conference with Hitler, and they were extreme. They began with an introduction denouncing the Czechs and the Czechoslovak state. For what reason, really? Because this is just all maneuvering and accusing them of, you know, Bolshevism, but it's posturing because simply they're in the way of plans. What Hitler wanted and really what Britain wanted. Okay, so they want to eliminate the Czechs, insisting that the country must abandon its foreign policy and cease to be an obstacle to the German drive to the east. See, they just wanted Czechoslovakia to just roll over, get out of the way, and let Hitler come on through. Part of they were the Carlsbad demands. Complete equality between Czechs and Germans, recognition of the German group as a corporation with legal personality, demarcation of the German areas, full self-government in those areas, legal protection for citizens outside those areas, and reparation for damages inflicted by the Czechs on the Sudetens since 1918, German officials in German areas, and full freedom to profess German nationality and German political philosophy. That is what was going on here, and there was nothing that the Czech state could do to get help from basically any end. France seemed to come through for a little while, and they had, I'll give you the three needs that France outlined to Britain. I can find those here. They said, Britain, agree with us, France, on these three things. We want naval conversations. We want you to ensure our ability to transport our troops that we have in Africa to France if we're in a crisis and we need them here. We want economic support for the Little Entente so that we don't have, that they can be saved from German pressure. And we want a promise that if Anglo-French pressure on Czechoslovakia results in extensive concessions to the Sudetens and Germany, and then refuse those concessions and try to destroy the Czech state, there will be an Anglo-French guarantee given to Czechoslovakia. And so the first of these two were postponed, so no naval support for France, and no economic support for the Little Entente. And the third, basically coming to the aid of Czechoslovakia if Hitler doesn't honor any agreement, was just flat out refused. It was also made clear to the French that in the event of any British-French war against Germany, Britain's contribution to this joint effort would be restricted to the air, since this was the only way in which Britain itself could be attacked. France tried to obtain assurance that these two divisions that Britain said it might be able to send would be motorized, but Britain refused to confirm that they would do that. It said here, the violence of these Anglo-French discussions is not reflected in the minutes published by the British government in 1949. And indeed, Chamberlain wrote to his sister the day after the discussions ended. Fortunately, the papers have had no hint of how near we came to a break with the French over Czechoslovakia. Quigley goes on to say that it was clear that Chamberlain was determined to write off the Sudetenland, so that's part of Czechoslovakia, and not go to war with Germany unless public opinion in England compelled it to do so. And, of course, they pretty much controlled public opinion. I'm sorry, I'm pausing. I don't have this marked off, but there was a note that I made that I wanted to talk about Hitler's aims about Czechoslovakia, but I don't. Oh, okay. In the meantime, the German occupation of Austria changed the strategic situation for Germany so that it was necessary for Hitler to modify his general order to the armed forces for operational plans against France, Czechoslovakia, and Austria. These orders had been issued June 24, 1937. The new directive, drafted by General Keitel on May 20, 1938, and submitted for Hitler's signature, began, "It is not my intention to smash Czechoslovakia by military action in the immediate future without provocation, unless an unavoidable development of the political conditions within Czechoslovakia forces the issue, or political events in Europe create a particularly favorable opportunity, which may perhaps never recur." So that was drafted by General Keitel, and it was entirely rewritten by Hitler and signed May 30, so 10 days later in 1938. The opening sentence then read, "It is my unalterable decision to smash Czechoslovakia by military action in the near future." It then went on to say that in case of war with Czechoslovakia, whether France intervened or not, all forces would be concentrated on the Czechs in order to achieve an impressive success in the first 3 days. He said he would deliver a decisive blow against Czechoslovakia. These orders, now, this part is really key here because it just shows once again what Britain could have done and chose not to. So these orders were so unrealistic that the German military leaders were aghast. They realized that the reality was so different from Hitler's picture of it that Germany would be defeated fairly readily in any war likely to arise over Czechoslovakia. All their efforts to make Hitler see the reality were completely unsuccessful, and as the crisis continued, they became more and more desperate until by the end of August, they were in a panic. This feeling was shared by the entire foreign ministry except for Ribbentrop. Hitler was isolated, it said, on his mountain retreat. He was cut off, as Quigley describes it. He was living in a dream world and very short-tempered. He was cut off from outside contacts by Ribbentrop, Himmler, and Hess, who told him that Russia, France, and Britain would not fight and that the Czechs were bluffing. One of the mysteries yet remaining is why Ribbentrop was so sure that Britain would not fight. He was right. So the German generals tried to, I'm just going to read this because I find it really interesting here, but the German generals tried to dissuade Hitler from this project, and when they found they had no influence over him, they persuaded various important people who were able to get in to see him to intervene for the same purpose. And they were able to get Admiral Miklos Horthy, regent of Hungary, to try to influence him during a visit August 21 through 26 of 1938. And Hitler just interrupted shouting, "Nonsense, shut up." So a conspiracy was formed. And I won't give you the names. There were various generals and some civil leaders. And they had a conspiracy. They came up with a plot. Their plot had three stages in it. One, to exert every effort to make Hitler see the truth. Two, to inform the British of their efforts and beg them to stand firm on the Czechoslovak issue and to tell the German government that Britain would fight if Hitler made war on Czechoslovakia. And three, to assassinate Hitler if he nevertheless issued the order to attack Czechoslovakia. Message after message was sent to Britain. And that's the first 2 weeks of September, by various people, by Weizsäcker, by a court, by the generals, by others in separate missions, and the British refused to cooperate, which I find very interesting. As a result, then, these conspirators had to resort to their plan to assassinate Hitler as soon as he ordered the attack. He ordered the attack, but then he canceled it. He didn't order the attack, but they ended up canceling at noon on September 28, 1938, because they heard that Chamberlain was going to Munich and he would yield. The attack order was to have been given by Hitler at 2 p.m. that day. So they held off on their assassination attempt. Let's see. So now I want to just cover the propaganda, because it's interesting to me that how intensely the British used propaganda. Okay, so we have what is reaching the public, and the only way that it can reach the public is through some kind of press releases or news or propaganda or whatever. But the mounting horror of the relentless German mobilization was built up day by day, while at the same time, Britain and France ordered the Czechs not to mobilize in order not to provoke Germany. Word was assiduously spread on all sides that Russia was worthless and would not fight, that Britain certainly would not go to war to prevent the Sudetens from exercising the democratic right of self-determination, and that Germany could overwhelm the Czechs in a few days and could wipe out Prague, Paris, and London from the air in the first day, and that these air attacks would be accompanied by gas attacks on the civilian population from the air, and that even if Germany could be defeated after years of war, Czechoslovakia would never be reconstructed because it was an artificial monstrosity, an aberration of 1919. We now know that all these statements and rumors were not true. The documentary evidence indicates that the British government knew that they were not true at the time. Germany had 22 partly trained divisions on the Czech frontier, while the Czechs had 17 first line and 11 other divisions, which were superior from every point of view except air support. In addition, they had excellent fortification and higher morale. And these facts were known to the British government. On September the 3rd, the British military attaché in Prague wrote to London, "There are no shortcomings in the Czech army, as far as I have been able to observe, which are of sufficient consequence to warrant a belief that it cannot give a good account of itself, even fighting alone. In my view, therefore, there is no material reason why they should not put up a really protracted resistance single-handed. It depends on their morale." And it's interesting. I tried to find out who that British military attaché was at the time, and I couldn't come up with a name. But all of this was known. The next note that I have made is Britain's role in carving up Czechoslovakia, just basically serving it up on a platter to Hitler. The way in which Chamberlain applied consultation with the Czechs, okay, so it was agreed that whatever they did in coming to terms, the supervising terms between Czechoslovakia and Germany would be done in consultation with the Czechs. And what we learn here is that there was no consultation whatsoever. It was just four great powers who got together and said, this is what it's going to be. The way in which Chamberlain applied consultation with the Czechs before partition was imposed is an interesting example of his mind at work. The British, French, and Czechs were agreed in opposition to the use of a plebiscite in this dispute, although the Entente suggested it to put pressure on the Czechs. And Chamberlain said, the idea of territorial cession would be likely to have a more favorable reception from the British public if it could be represented as the choice of the Czechoslovak government themselves and could be made clear that they had been offered the choice of a plebiscite or of territorial cession and had preferred the latter. This would dispose of any idea that we were ourselves carving up Czechoslovak territory, which is in fact what they did. So there was no consultation. They basically said, we're going to pretend that the Czechs offered a plebiscite. We're going to pretend that they were given the choice between plebiscite and ceding the Sudetenland, and we're going to pretend that they preferred the latter. And this was completely made up by Britain. It said, at 3 p.m. on Wednesday, September 28th, Chamberlain met Parliament for the first time during the crisis to inform it of what had been done. The whole city of London was in a panic. They think that the Germans are coming and they've got their gas masks. The honorable members sat hunched on their benches, waiting for Goring's bombs to come through the roof. As Chamberlain drew to the end of his long speech, a message was brought to him. He announced that it was an invitation to a four-power conference at Munich on Thursday. There was a roar of joy and relief as Chamberlain hurried from the building without any formal ending to the session. So here they are. They're meeting now in Munich. Hitler, Chamberlain, Mussolini, and Daladier, I don't know how you say that, the Frenchman, carved up Czechoslovakia without consulting anyone, least of all the Czechs. The conference lasted from 12:30 p.m. on September 29th to 2:30 a.m. So it took them, 14 hours to carve it up. When the agreement of the four powers was handed to the Czech minister in Berlin, who had been waiting outside the door for over 10 hours, the agreement reached Prague only 18 hours before the German occupation was to begin. The Munich Agreement provided that certain designated areas of Czechoslovakia would be occupied by the German army in four stages from October the 1st to October the 7th. A fifth area to be designated by an international commission would be occupied by October the 10th. No property was to be withdrawn from those areas. The International Commission would order plebiscites, which must be held before the end of November, the areas designated being occupied by an international force during the interval. The Munich Agreement was violated on every point in favor of Germany, so that ultimately the German army merely occupied the places it wanted. As a result, the Czech economic system was destroyed, and every important railroad or highway was cut or crippled. This was done by the International Commission, consisting of German Secretary of State Weizsäcker, and the French, British, Italian, and Czech diplomatic representatives in Berlin. It's amazing. It said all these events showed very clearly that the chief result of what they called the Munich Agreement, Germany was the supreme power in Central Europe. Any possibility of curtailing that power, either by a joint policy of the Western powers with the Soviet Union and Italy, or by finding any openly anti-German resistance in Central Europe itself, was ended, since this was exactly what Chamberlain and his friends had wanted, they should have been satisfied. So it's interesting to get this perspective that I'll just say that the three block boys, the round table group, the Cliveden set, wanted Germany to be the strongest power in Central Europe, and that's what they got. Okay.
Melissa, can I add a few points?
Oh, please.
I just wanted to add that a really great book that Alan referred to with regards to the Second World War, if you follow the money and business, it's that book, Trading with the Enemy. I think the surname of the author is Haim. You know, you could see how the bankers on both sides of the Atlantic funded all sides of the war, and how large European and American corporations worked together. In actual fact, very large Nazi-backed corporations actually opened up shop in America and South America with the full knowledge of the American government. So there again, you know, it backs up what we're reading about in the spirit. So if you haven't read Trading with the Enemy, if you've got the time, I would really recommend reading that book with these few chapters. It really fills in the spaces over there. Just another point is that, you know, when Germany took over Czechoslovakia, they basically inherited all of that superb Czechoslovakian army hardware, which enabled them to then, it gave them the military hardware to attack on two fronts and to hit Russia. I also wrote here, I think it'll come up in the next section. That's all I've got for Czechoslovakia.
Well, there were just a couple of things that I was reminded of or that I thought about when I was reading this. The first was the idea of the League of Nations and really what a joke it was. The League of Nations as a, what did they call it? Their blanket of peace or their collective security. That's what it was. Their security blanket, their collective security. And I know that that Japan and Germany dropped out of the league in the early 30s, and I think that the Soviet Union was in it briefly in the mid-30s, but not very long. So, I mean, you're not going to be bound by the ideas of collective security if you're not participating. But there still would be, considering who was left at that time in the League of Nations. I mean, if you look at what Britain was doing and their machinations, this was in no way in the spirit of collective security.
It's just earlier on, I think in the previous chapter, you know, it raises the point that the League of Nations was not in the eyes of the round table groups to be a European body, but an international body. And it didn't really have much to do in their eyes with the balance of power in Europe, more than it had to do with running the world like an international country. So it was more to do with, you know, social structures and laws, and to really just standardize nation states. You know, the United Nations was really just the way of you bury the nations internationalism, as Alan would say. It's it was really more to do with an international government, a practical government. And a lot of people back then were given a very false understanding of what the League of Nations was.
Yeah, I just was looking at the League of Nations on Wiki this morning, and it said current scholarly consensus views that even though the League failed to achieve its main goal of world peace, it did manage to build new roads towards expanding the rule of law across the globe, strengthen the concept of collective security, gave a voice to smaller nations, fostered economic stabilization and financial security, raised awareness of problems like epidemics, slavery, child labor, refugee crises. And that immediately made me think, well, you know, everybody talks about how much better the UN is, but I just thought about how powerless the UN often is on doing things that actually contribute to world peace. I mean, this is a headline from just about a week and a half ago. It said, UN General Assembly demands Israel end unlawful presence in occupied Palestinian territory. The other thing that struck me is the acceptance among all of the powers that the German idea, that Hitler's idea of Lebensraum was in keeping, was sympathetic to the idea of collective security, because this was just expansionism. It was expanding Germany's boundaries. And again, I made that parallel in my mind to the Israeli settlements. And I thought, what would happen if I put in Lebensraum and West Bank on a search engine? And sure enough, I came up, it's behind a paywall, but there is a Haaretz article from 2011 that said Lebensraum as a justification for Israeli settlements.
Very interesting.
Yeah, we were fortunate when we occupied the West Bank, because had we not done so, where would we have come to live? Who knows how high housing prices would have risen? I found another one from the year before from a Palestinian point of view, though, that raises the same questions. So the idea that somebody can expand just because they think that's a good idea, and the so-called international community just stands by and allows that to happen, it's interesting.
I think of the United Nations, I always go back to Star Trek. The United Nations, I think, is in Star Trek land. It's the Federation. The USS Enterprise is, I suppose, it's America's role behind the United Nations as they go around trying to create peace with these different groups.
Do you want to dive into
the year of
dupes, 1939?
Okidoks. Okay, the year of dupes. Well, we know what dupe means. It's concerning 1939, 1938. I just wanted to clarify what the Munich Agreement was. So I just looked into that a bit. The Munich Agreement, it was signed off on the 30th of September, 1938. And there were four parties to that agreement, which was Nazi Germany, represented by Adolf Hitler, the United Kingdom, represented by Neville Chamberlain, the French Republic, represented by Edouard Daladier, and Fascist Italy, represented by Benito Mussolini. It provided for the German annexation of the Sudetenland. That was its key. It was also known on the other side of the equation as the Munich Betrayal. On the 21st and 22nd of September, Poland and Hungary also made demands on Czechoslovakian territory. Russia said they'd assist Czechoslovakia if Poland and Romania allowed its army to pass through their lands, to which they declined. So once again, Czechoslovakia was vulnerable. So the end, a result of the Munich Agreement is that just about everyone conceded to Hitler's terms. It was sold as a means to prevent a major war or bloodbath. Hitler announced it was his last territorial claim in Europe. It was known as a foiled, sorry, I can't read my own handwriting. It was known as a failed act of appeasement. Then I made a note. I said, personally, I think Germany and Hitler were induced to wage war in order to achieve the three block plan, but also to make sure. Okay, this is, yes. Personally, I think Germany and Hitler were induced to wage war in order to achieve the three block plan, but also to make sure that Hitler was out of the picture afterwards. Otherwise, none of it would have worked in the long run. It's a bit like the Russian Revolution, you know, you get those early groups to start upsetting the apple cart and taking over, but essentially those kinds of people are traitors, and they're also ambitious. They will want to be in on the in the big looting afterwards, to which they were never meant to be a part of, so, you know, they get lined up against the wall and shot. It was a similar sort of thing here with Hitler. You can't have a warlord with a big ego remaining in power in Germany, because they wanted a stable Europe as a buffer to Russia. And it was this very much the same thing with Winston Churchill. As soon as World War II was over, they booted him out. So I just said the next set, or the next stage after World War II would not have worked with the likes of Hitler or Churchill at the reins. And then page 639, I start off reading the first part, plans for appeasement by Chamberlain and plans for aggression by Hitler did not end with this Munich agreement. Within 3 weeks of this agreement, Hitler issued orders to his generals to prepare plans to destroy the rump of Czechoslovakia. For those who might not know what that means, a rump state is what is what remains of a state once a section of its territory has been annexed by another. So he issued his generals to prepare plans to destroy the rump of Czechoslovakia and to annex a Memel from Lithuania. A month later, he added Danzig to this list. Although he signified his desire to achieve this through a revolutionary action without a war against Poland. This reluctance for war against Poland did not arise from any affection for peace, but from the fact that he had not made up his mind whether to attack France or Poland. He was inclined at first to attack westward and did not change his mind and decide to deal first with Poland until later on, April the 1st, 1939. Mussolini was demanding his share of territory, and he was making quite a nuisance of himself. He was wanting to get back territory which he felt was his, that was now part of France, which is Nice, Corsica, and Tunis. Chamberlain encouraged this on, and was part of the British plan to, if you remember, the circles and counter-circles. France was attempting to encircle Germany. So you can see how the British plan to actually encircle France played into the hands here by encouraging Mussolini. February the 6th, 1939, news got out that Hitler was going to attack Holland and France. In that case, he acknowledged Britain's commitment to aid France. Italian demands on France raised France's fighting spirit. Ribbentrop even visited Paris to sign a treaty of neutrality on December the 6th, 38. France agreed to give Germany assistance in Eastern Europe. General, I just wrote here, I was just summarizing. So general paranoia caused countries like France to take missteps like this, as no one could trust the other to honor their agreements. So appeasements like this were made with Germany foolishly. The French were worried that Britain would seek to detach Mussolini from Hitler by making concessions to Italy at the expense of France. Essentially, Britain had engineered a series of tensions that artificially put Germany in the driving seat, forcing the other powers to seek concessions from it, which, I wrote the word genius, to kiss Germany's butt through deception. So well played to Britain. They from their vantage point, were able to apply leverage very, very cleverly to arrange this these steps. March 3rd, 39, Hitler was ready to hit the rump of Czechoslovakia. Hungary was invited, and they accepted on March the 13th. Meanwhile, in Czechoslovakia, in the Sudetenland, generally in Czechoslovakia, Sudeten Nazis overran the area. Poland and Hungary were lining up to get their slices of territory out of Slovakia and Ruthenia, and also a little bit of land from the Bohemia-Moravia area. Slovakia was run by Monsignor Tiso, or Joseph Tiso. Once again, another good Christian. Sorry, no offense. It's just that there's another Monsignor that comes up here. And he collaborated with the Nazis to run Slovakia as a Klein state, the first Slovak Republic. Joseph Tiso was executed for treason in 1947. He was very well known for supporting the Nazis with regards to deporting Jews, murdering Jews. He was certainly a Monsignor by title only. I can just imagine him being a little supplicating coward. March the 14th, 1939. How do you say his name? Is it Hoxha? President of Czechoslovakia was forced by Hitler to sign documents.
I think it's Hoxha.
Hoxha, sorry, that's it. You should see my handwriting. It's terrible, Melissa. It looks like chicken scratching. Was forced by Hitler to sign documents handing Czechoslovakia over to Hitler and insisting that resistance to the German forces to end. Let's see. So they shortly, which the they is Bohemia, Moravia, and Slovakia, were shortly declared German protectorates, and Ruthenia was annexed by Hungary. March the 22nd, Germany took Memel from Lithuania. Just looked up memo. The name for it today is Klaipeda, K-L-A-I-P-E-D-A. I don't know how to pronounce it, but what was important about it and why they wanted it was that it was originally part of Prussia, so it was German in their eyes, and also it was a port city that was generally ice-free most of the time. And, of course, Hitler needed access to the ocean from certain vantage points where he could get his U-boats and ships in and out, you know. So it was quite a strategic area. And then we read that Italy seized Albania quickly he just dismisses it as almost a nothing. Little Albania didn't matter. And that happened in April 1939. Hopping back, March 1939 is said to mark the end of the appeasement era. Although Britain continued secretly to appease Germany whilst publicly doing the opposite, we learn that Hitler, despite frequent visits by British diplomats to guide Hitler along the 7-point plan and the 8-point plan, ultimately Hitler didn't really want a Lebensraum for fellow Germans. He wanted personal prestige and world domination. And that very important point of the 7 points was that Britain would back him all the way, as long as he didn't use violence. And yet he wanted glory and conquest. So page 642, sorry, January 1939, the diplomats were sending London news, or diplomats from around Europe were sending London news of Hitler's intentions for Western Europe, which got everyone very, very alarmed. Concessions continued, but efforts were being made now to confront Hitler behind the scenes. Once these conditions, or when they would break down, they would be able to militarily deal with Hitler. After March 17, concessions had to be secret. Appeasement were made because rearmament was going slowly. And it was also done to win time, although Quigley mentions that it was actually really more to do with strengthening Germany. So the anti-Bolshevik group and the three bloc groups, those inner circles of the round tables, they also demanded continued concessions, while Chamberlain pressed on with his 7-point plan. So even when news is coming in that Germany is not going to muck about, they are finished talking. They still were bluffing the world and bluffing the British public and secretly making concessions with Germany. The true nature of the concessions was actually to strengthen Germany. Okay, mentioned that already. So page 40. So I've underlined a fair amount to read here. The projects of the anti-Bolsheviks and the three-block world supporters were too dangerous to admit publicly, but they were sufficiently well known in Berlin to lead to the belief, even in moderate circles, that Britain would never go to war for Poland. For example, Weizsäcker, the German Secretary of State, chided Neville Henderson in June 1939 for abandoning his often repeated statement that England desired to retain the sea. the European continent could be left to Germany. However, these two groups, although still active in 1939 and even in 1940, had not originally envisaged the complete destruction of Czechoslovakia or Poland. They had expected that Hitler would get the Sudetenland, Danzig, and perhaps the Polish corridor, and that he would then be stabilized between the Oceanic bloc and the Soviet Union, with contact with the latter across the Baltic states. It was expected that a rump Czechoslovakia and a rump Poland would be able to survive between Germany and Russia. And those are your buffer states, I imagine. As Holland or Switzerland could survive between the Oceanic bloc and Germany. Moreover, the three-bloc world supporters never wanted Hitler to drive southward either to the Adriatic or to the Aegean. Accordingly, although divided in respect to Romania and the Black Sea, they were determined to support Turkey and Greece against both Germany and Italy. So, you know, that tells you a bit, a fair amount there. They definitely had very particular strategy for the future Europe to come. As a consequence of these hidden and conflicting forces, the history of international relations from September 1938 to September 1939, or even later, is neither simple nor consistent. Telling me. In general, the key to everything was the position of Britain. There you go. For the aims of the other countries concerned, were relatively simple. As a result of the dualistic, or as Lord Halifax's biographer calls it, diarchic policy of Britain, which that's their general strategy for hundreds of years, there were not only two policies, but two groups carrying them out. This is very interesting. The Foreign Office, under Lord Halifax, tried to satisfy the public demand for an end to appeasement and the construction of a united front against Germany. Chamberlain, with his own personal group, including Sir Horace Wilson, Sir John Simon, and Sir Hamuel Hoar, sought to make secret concessions to Hitler in order to achieve a general Anglo-German settlement on the basis of those 7 points we've covered. The one policy was public, the other was secret. Since the Foreign Office knew both, it tried to build up the peace front against Germany so that it would look sufficiently imposing to satisfy public opinion in England and to drive Hitler to seek his desires by negotiation rather than by force, so that public opinion in England would not force the government to declare war that they did not want in order to remain in office. This complex plan broke down because Hitler was determined to have a war merely for the personal, emotional thrill of wielding great power, while the effort to make a peace front sufficiently collapsible so that it could be cast aside if Hitler either obtained his goals by negotiation or made a general settlement with Chamberlain, merely resulting in making a peace front, in air quotes, which was so weak it could neither maintain peace by the threat of force nor win a war when peace was lost. Above all, these involved maneuvers drove the Soviet Union into the arms of Hitler. I made a note here. The phony peace front with Germany ended up driving the Soviet Union into Hitler's arms. March the 15th, 1939, Chamberlain told the House of Commons he had accepted the seizure of Czechoslovakia. All right, so I'm jumping about a little bit. This is the part of the book, Melissa, where I started getting a bit battle-weary because, you know, he takes you through all of these intrigues, but they they tend to start sounding very familiar. And so I just said, it was all just a game of smoke and mirrors, keeping the public happy. Economic concessions, they actually handed over Czechoslovakian gold, which was stored in London, to Germany. Just remember that as I say this, remember up to now what Germany has done and how aggressive they have been. And still, under their own public's nose, they are doing all of this. It's just something else. Chamberlain persisted with the 7-point plan with Hitler, and Hitler kept pushing for more and more concessions. Page 645, Goering declared Germany broke on October 14, 1938. He promised to crack down on any private business that would not pull its weight for the Nazi war machine. And then it goes on to say the Entente powers actually sought to alleviate these problems. So just when you're out in public and you watch TV and you watch a documentary about World War II, everything the public in general is fed with regarding Hitler and Germany and Britain and how Churchill was such an amazing guy, all the amazing quotes attributed to Churchill, et cetera, that Churchill saved Germany. So it saved Britain from Germany and from Hitler. You know, it's the complete opposite. They, these people, to the right until the point of war, and actually a couple of days after the declaration of war in Europe, they continued to seek concessions with Hitler. They actually built Germany up through by hook or by crook. And look at the incredible destruction, misery and sadness that it brought on the world. And this is what a real psychopath is happy to do. They're dressed in suits and ties and fancy trench coats and top hats and walking canes. And they are quite happy to sacrifice the lives of millions. It's just unreal. So the economic part of this is that Britain went so far as to arrange through the Federation of British Industries to negotiate industrial cooperation with the German industry, to set up cartels even, to fix prices of how many countries was it? 50 different countries or something like that. Come November 1938, that was a big event. You had it was called a Kristallnacht or Crystal Night, otherwise known as the Night of Broken Glass. Germany also made agreements with Poland for Danzig and to join an anti-Russian bloc. So I've jumped all the way to page 648. So as things were heating up, the text of Chamberlain's guarantee to Poland is of extreme importance. He said, certain consultations are now proceeding with other governments. In order to make perfectly clear the position of His Majesty's government in the meantime, before those consultations are concluded, I now have to inform the House of Commons that during that period, in the event of any action which clearly threatened Polish independence, and while the Polish government accordingly considered it vital to resist with their national forces, His Majesty's government would feel themselves bound at once to lend the Polish government all support in their power. This was an extraordinary assurance. You know, the duplicitous British government since 1918 had resolutely refused any bilateral agreement guaranteeing any state in the Western Europe, now they were making unilateral declaration in Eastern Europe, and they were giving that state the responsibility of deciding when that guarantee would take effect. Something quite unprecedented. A little thought will show that these strange features really stultify the guarantee, and the net result was to leave the situation exactly where it had been before, except that a very severe warning had been conveyed in this fashion to Germany, to use negotiation and not force. In my opinion, it was just to keep the appeasement period going for as long as possible. If Germany used force against Poland, public opinion in Britain would force Britain to declare war, whether there was a guarantee or not. This unprecedented unilateral declaration, to me, just my personal understanding, is that it was, the time was coming, and everyone behind the scenes and in power knew it, and they needed to kick off World War II. And this was the point in time where the referee was standing with his whistle waiting to start the game of World War II. The fact that Chamberlain's guarantee was temporary and unilateral left the British free to cancel it when necessary. The fact that it guaranteed Poland's independence and not its territorial integrity left the way open for Germany to get Danzig or the corridor by negotiation. And the fact that it came into effect when Poland wished made it impossible for Britain or British public opinion to refuse to accept any change which Poland worked out in negotiation with Hitler. Most of these points were recognized by the German government. They were pointed out in the Times of April the 1st and accepted by Chamberlain. If the chief purpose of the unilateral guarantee to Poland was to frighten Germany, it had precisely the opposite effect. On hearing of it, Hitler made his decision to attack Poland by September 1. Orders to this effect were issued to the German army on April the 3rd, and the plan for Operation White, as it was called, were ready on April the 11th. On April the 28th, in a public speech to the Reichstag, Hitler denounced the Anglo-German agreement of 1935 and the Polish-German Non-Aggression Pact of 1934. So I jump ahead. The Poles, they were exhorted to negotiate with Germany, despite Hitler being committed to a war path. And they continued to press Germany to be peaceful. This is just the activities of the inner circle. I'm just really summarizing broadly. It just goes on and on. Germany made concessions. Then the likes of Chamberlain pushed on with Hitler to get him to adhere to these 7-point plans, these 7 points. And it was a back and forth, and Hitler was sort of stringing them along. But I think, I personally think that the round table groups were stringing Hitler along. They were playing the game. And Hitler was taking all those little baits that were set up as they were stroking his ego. In the midst of all of this, Britain opened negotiations with Russia to join a peace front. And on page 652, I wanted to just highlight something here. It says, We have mentioned that the economic discussions between Britain and Germany, which were publicly broken off on March 28th, were secretly reopened 5 days later. News of these negotiations leaked out, apparently from the French, who wished to break them off, but the rumor was that the discussions were concerned with Chamberlain's efforts to give Germany a loan of £1 billion. These offers were repeated in a highly secret conversation between Dirksen and Wilson in the latter's residence on August 3rd. Wilson wanted a four-power pact, a free hand for Germany in Eastern Europe, a colonial agreement, an economic agreement, and so forth. Dirksen's record of this conversation then reads, after recapitulating his conversation with Wolstadt, Sir Horace Wilson expatiated at length on the great risk Chamberlain would incur by starting confidential negotiations with the German government. If anything about them were to leak out, there would be a grand scandal and Chamberlain would probably be forced to resign. Dirksen did not see how any binding agreement could be reached under conditions such as this. For example, owing to Hudson's indiscretion, another visit of Herr Wolstadt to London was out of the question. To this, Wilson suggested that the two emissaries could meet in Switzerland or elsewhere. It was pointed out by Wilson that if Britain could get a non-aggression pact with Germany, it would adopt a non-intervention policy in respect to Greater Germany. This would embrace the Danzig question. For example, it is clear that these negotiations were not a purely personal policy of Chamberlain's, but were known to the Foreign Office. For example, on August the 9th, Lord Halifax repeated much of the political portion of these conversations. After Munich, he said he had looked forward to 50 years of peace with Germany, the dominant power on the continent, with predominant rights in southeastern Europe, particularly in the field of commercial policy. Britain would engage only in moderate trade in that area. In Western Europe, Britain and France, protected from conflicts with Germany by the lines of fortification on both sides and endeavoring to retain and develop their positions by defensive means. Friendship with America, friendship with Portugal, Spain, for the time, being an indefinite factor for which the next few years at least would necessarily have to hold aloof. From all combinations of powers, Russia, an out-of-the-way, vast and scarcely surveyable territory, with Britain bent on safeguarding her Mediterranean communications with dominions and the Far East, this was three-block world, talk straight from All Souls College or Cliveden. And it's exactly what we saw after World War II. It's exactly what we've seen with the European Union. And of course we are in 2024. I think we are seeing, you know, as we've gone through chapter 12 and 13, what's happening in the Ukraine and the things that are building up in Europe militarily, I can't help to see such strong parallels with the leading up to what we see leading up to World War II. It seems to be repeating itself in 2024. And I wouldn't be surprised if we do see a World War III. Not to sound depressing, but I think that they do need to shake up the world again to take it to the next stage. And warfare gets people over that hump. It shocks them into moving. So the negotiations for an Anglo-Russian agreement were opened by Britain on April the 15th, probably with the double purpose of satisfying the demand in Britain and warning Hitler not to use force against Poland. The first British suggestion was that the Soviet Union should give unilateral guarantees to Poland and Romania, similar to those given by Britain. The Russians probably regarded this as a trap to get them into a war with Germany, in which Britain would do little or nothing, or even give aid to Germany. The Russians were quite savvy. I jumped ahead. I was getting quite fatigued, Melissa, so I just started off at the bottom of page 657. I said the German invasion of Poland at 4:45 a.m. on the 1st of September 1939 did not by any means end the negotiations to make peace, nor for that matter did the complete collapse of Polish resistance on September the 16th and 17th. Since these efforts were futile, little need be said of them, except that France and Britain did not declare war on Germany until more than 2 days had elapsed. I wonder why. Wink, wink. Nudge, nudge. During this time, no ultimatums were sent to Germany, but she was begged to withdraw her forces from Poland and open negotiations. There's that appeasement right up until... it's crazy. While Poland shuddered under the impact of the first Blitzkrieg, British public opinion began to grumble, and even the government's supporters in Parliament became restive. Finally, at 9 a.m. on September the 3rd, Henderson presented to Schmidt, Hitler's interpreter, an ultimatum which expired at 11 a.m. In a similar fashion, France entered the war at 6 p.m. on September the 3rd. And then if you page ahead in Tragedy and Hope, after World War II, we'll get to the chapter entitled, is it entitled The New World Order? Well, that gives you a major clue as to what World War II was for. It completely did a great reset on the public mind in Europe and to the great extent worldwide. So I still think that Tragedy and Hope is a very relevant book to read. When I think back on chapter 12 and chapter 13, I think I can see a terrible similarity between then and now. Will there be a physical conflagration again? It would seem like they are using very similar strategy. And so I think that it is practical. It still is practical, and it's not paranoia to prepare for rationing. If the war in Ukraine and Israel, if they suck in international players and things start turning into World War III, prices of food will skyrocket. So, you know, use your own discretion, but I think it might be a worthwhile to consider what you've got stored in your cupboards. Not to go overboard and to panic and be worried and everything like that, but I think that for people back then, pre-World War II, I'm sure there would have been people who knew what was coming and could work it out. And they probably benefited by recognizing that intuition and going with it. And I think that's all I've got to say for that.
Excellent, Darren. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry, Melissa. I just rattled through it. Would you like to discuss anything?
There were a couple of things. There was something that I wanted to point out in the section that I covered there on the carving up of Czechoslovakia, what they call the Czechoslovak crisis, it jumped out at me. Lindbergh. Charles Lindbergh was an American World War I hero, and sadly his son was kidnapped and murdered. He was held for ransom. It was an infant. He and his wife, to escape all the press, they relocated to Europe. And there have been some assertions that he was a Nazi sympathizer. I think he had a few things to say that were not, possibly could be anti-Semitic. I'm not sure. I've never looked too deeply into that. But what you have is a hero that was used to get reports on what the Germans were up to. And it quickly doesn't dig too much into this, but I found it very interesting that it was Lindbergh's extreme overestimation of German capability that had, that played such a big part in the public imagination of getting gas masks and Hitler's on his way. I don't know if this was an innocent thing. He was very in. He'd made 5 or 6 different visits to Germany, and he was shown, I think he was taken by high level people on tours of their military bases and shown their qualities and all of the planes that they had and everything that they could do. And I don't know if this was their exaggerating that he took at face value or if somebody else was using him, but I found that to be interesting. It's again, you know, he was American, but he was reporting back to Britain. And there was another little thing in the section that you just covered. Again, this mysterious British military attaché who is not named. The 8th point, you know, there were those 7 points. The 8th point that came up later was Britain's eagerness to help Germany economically. And you touched on all of the ways that panned out. But the British military attaché protested in a letter saying, "We can only reduce the speed and scope of the universal armaments race by forcing a reduction of tempo on Germany. Germany is apparently now in dire economic straits. We have not applied the economic screw. Germany has tightened it down herself, and it is surely unsound for us to ease it before Germany has made an effort to do so herself. From the military point of view, concessions made by us to the present regime in Germany are generally to be deplored. The opposition in Germany and our potential allies in a possible war, above all America, are becoming more and more convinced of our weakness and lack of will or power to stand up to Germany." So we can only surmise, because Quigley never tells us who this military attaché is, that he was not in an inner circle. And that kind of duplicity in the British government is throughout here. You covered very well their unilateral declaration. It's just over and over. The public assertion by Britain that Germany was going to be okay if they were given Danzig, and Hitler coming out and saying in a secret conference that he had with his generals that Danzig is not the subject of this dispute at all. It's a question of our expanding our living space in the East and securing our food supplies, et cetera, et cetera. You know, he said to attack Poland. Here's his goal: to attack Poland at the first suitable opportunity.
Something that leaps to my mind is something that we've all been through in 2020. When you read this, this manipulation of Britain to downplay their abilities and their war readiness, to give the world the impression that Germany is this incredibly powerful bogeyman, and to convince the world, it reminds me of the COVID event, because it was driven very, very masterfully by playing on the fear, the reflex that we all have, playing on the emotions, to the point where very, very well educated clinicians throughout the healthcare system were all sort of taken in through fear, but also bringing out, getting people to all dance and sing and clap for the NHS to leverage their empathy. And they completely played the world. And we see the masterful deception that the British government and the establishment used. They used the same kind of thing in this appeasement operation. I think this era of appeasement was a very, very carefully planned operation, a proper operation to set up the stage for World War II in a way that would guarantee an outcome that they had pre-planned. So this appeasement period, I think, could have been planned easily 20 to 30 years ahead. It's very, very well organized. And somebody like a Lindbergh could very, very easily have been part of a family involved who had a family in politics, in Masonic groups. And because Lindbergh might not have been seen as a spy or that kind of thing, he would have been happy to play along. We'll never really know. But yeah, that Anglo-American establishment, I am personally very impressed in a disgusted sort of way at how they are able to do all of this and come out at the other end as being the good guys. It's just, it's astounding.
Yes, you're right. Well, I wonder if anybody, before we wrap up, I wonder if there is anyone listening who wanted to say anything at all.
This is Fiona. I'd like to say thank you for the presentations, because it's really educational. And I don't think my knowledge of history is that great. And I've been, as I follow this book club, I'm like, you know, learning a lot. But one of the things that you said, Darren, tonight was about and Melissa, you were talking about the League of Nations and then the United Nations and things like that. And it got me thinking about how Jens Stoltenberg is the leader of the United Nations. I think he's going to be retiring from it soon or finding something else to get up to. But he's... I was speaking to this old man, because often from, like, as they change history and you do stuff, if you can actually get somebody who is alive and who remembers what happened, and I asked this man, the older man here, I says, did I remember it wrong? I can't find it anywhere, but I know there's videos of Jens Stoltenberg protesting about NATO, you know, like dressed like a hippie and banners, and he was in the Youth Labour Party and protesting about NATO. They weren't going to have Norway joining NATO and all that. I was like, am I imagining this? Was it right? Yeah, it was right. Yeah, oh, that's right, yeah. And it ends up that he was, he's also a really international guy, this one, because he was born in New York, but his name's Stoltenberg is actually German. And his father's, and I think they were a political family and all this stuff, so the ground was laid for him. He went to the Rudolf Steiner School in Oslo, so he's got that. And I think he was involved in the Statistics Central Bureau and right in the statistics and that. But the point is, Norway is also sitting on a lot of money, with the oil money. So a lot of people from politics in Norway have moved into top positions, like, United Nations, Jens Stoltenberg, Gro Harlem Brundtland, the leader for WHO, and recently, if I believe this is correct, the guy that's taking over for the World Economic Forum was in the Labour Party with his pal Jens and all this, and Grandma Gro and all this. So they're all, and they're sitting on a lot of money. The Norwegian country is stinking rich with the oil money. And I read, I was in Wikipedia as well, that Jens Stoltenberg has given a lot of money to Bill Gates for his vaccination stuff that he's doing in Africa. And I read that there was something else. What else was it he did? I know that the Norwegian government gives a lot of money to the Clinton Foundation in their time. I don't know what they're doing with it now. But Norway sits in a lot of money. So a lot of people seem to get these top jobs in these international organizations. I just thought I'd add that. Something for what you were saying, Darren, about things going faster, and like what Alan says about who are these actors actually that are in this. It's getting me wondering, you know, the international stuff. Why would they want these people? Yeah. So that was that.
Fiona, I wanted to just ask you. You mentioned that Jens Stoltenberg, that he, you said that he had spoken out against NATO at one point. And I found that interesting because he is the head of NATO at the moment.
Yes, that's correct. In his youth.
Yeah, Secretary General.
His youth, he was a protester against NATO. You know,
amazing,
in the streets and with his banners and all that. Because Norway has been kind of, apart from stuff like, I mean, you know, you've got Sweden who isn't in it, or they're maybe joining now, but there was a huge thing, and Jens Stoltenberg was one of the big guys in it. And as I said to this, you can't find the videos anywhere now. I've tried to find it, I've searched YouTube everywhere, but I asked this older man who lives here, who's a chemist and into, you know, all politics, he'll talk to anybody about anything. He says, yes, you're correct, you're remembering correctly. Isn't that fascinating? They're like chameleons, you know? Yeah.
If their mouths are moving, they're lying. Yeah.
Yeah. He actually has a sister who was also a heroin addict, and his other sister is a doctor, and she is the head of, them who were deciding who was going to be getting, if it was going to be mandatory vaccinations, etc. It's called the Folk Health Institute, but I think it would be like the Folk Health Institution. I think it's equivalent to the American CDC or something. You know, like them who decide what's going to be happening with health, you know. So it's, quite a family.
That's funny, Fiona. I just looked up and found there is it's a audio or video where Christiane Amanpour from CNN is interviewing Stoltenberg. I don't have a year on it or anything, but the title of it is From Protesting NATO to Leading It. Interesting.
Yeah, there you got it. Yeah. It makes you think. So, but it was a really wonderful educational talk tonight. I understood a lot of it. Sometimes I don't get a lot, but maybe through listening every week. But I'm starting to sort of click.
So Fiona, do you feel like doing a chapter with me or with Darren coming up?
Oh yeah.
Thanks for asking, but at this point, I think I'm going to wait for the next book, which is hopefully Alan's. And then I would definitely love to do it. But I'm a bit tentative because of my history is, when we went to school, you could choose history or geography, and I took geography. So it's really got loads of holes in it. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, Fiona, if you change your mind, there is at the end of the book, there is an interesting chapter called The Future in Perspective. Now, remember, he wrote this in the mid-60s, but it's not super dense in history, and it's a very interesting chapter with a lot of social commentary. So if you change your mind.
Well, I'll take a look at it, Melissa. Thank you. And I have a background with sociology, so I could maybe use that, but history is
great.
Thank you for asking. I think it sounds great. Yeah. What about you, Christine?
Melissa?
What did you say, Christine? My analytical skills are not up to at this point. I'm living on fresh air. Just surviving. I like listening. It's been very enjoyable. Thanks.
I have it on good authority, Melissa, that a certain Andrea would like to cover the New Age chapter.
Oh, a certain Andrea.
I'm not volunteering. Sorry. You misunderstood.
I think we need to strong arm a certain Andrea into doing that with one of us, maybe the two of you. I'd love that.
No, but not too much pressure on Andrea, but it would be nice to hear from some of the others. I lose too much. I think I get about 10 extra gray hairs whenever I cover a chapter. It's so I'd like someone else to get some gray hairs on their head as well.
We haven't picked on Faith. She's not going to respond.
Is anyone else got anything to add or questions to ask?
Oh, sorry, guys. Sorry. You know what? I'm sitting here and I tried to go on, but I was pressing the wrong button. But you know, it's funny, Melissa. I was just thinking about it and I thought, oh, I should say something to thank Melissa and Darren just for all the work you put in, to helping us, to bring us together. You know, just hearing everybody's voices and knowing that you're all out there. We're not alone. It's just amazing. It's made my weekend. Honest to goodness, it's made my weekend. And I just want to thank you, Melissa, for all the work you put, not only in the videos, but the talks, the research. Oh my gosh, you talk about Alan. What about you? And then you're talking about like World War III, Darren. I'm going through Alan's talks. I start at the beginning. I'm in 2010 and I'm in March. And you look at the H1N1 and you look at the COVID. It's exactly the same thing. And you're right. Mm-hmm. They totally are leading us into a World War III.
Sorry, not to be alarmist or jump on an alarm bandwagon, but I believe it was in the November 22, 2020 talk that I used portions of in the last Real History. And I've been listening to segments of that over the last couple of weeks. I believe it was that talk where Alan was discussing the trains that were passing by. And this is true. I was there. The trains were loud. The tracks were right by the house, but the frequency with which they passed and the heaviness, you could tell by the sound that they made during 2020, was astonishing. And Alan was making the point, where are those going? And he was talking about underground bases, because there were those in the area where we lived. And I'm sure that they're, you know, in a lot of places that we're unaware of. We just happen to be aware of one very close to us. He said they're stocking up. They are preparing for their, you know, continuity of government kinds of plans that they do. And he said that, you know, the kinds of stocks and supplies that are going by in the train on a regular basis, this is preparation for generations to survive in some kind of an underground base. And we know that they've advertised their seed arcs and their DNA arcs, where they have, I think Iceland has one. There's one in, I don't remember, somewhere in the States, but they're in various parts of the world where they've, you know, it's like Noah's Ark. They've got, you know, a little bit of everything so that they can rebuild the world. And I don't say that to be alarmist. I say that because it's pretty obvious that they've been preparing for worst case scenario for some time now.
Just to interrupt, I would like to say my motto has been for the last 4 or 5 years, have no fear. Fear nothing. Whatever's going to happen will happen. They want you to be scared, and that's it.
a small yes. contribution.
That is a good motto, Christine. I mean, I say these things, but I feel that way. I live that way, and that is how we have to be, because there's more here at stake. Then, you know, we have to talk about the war on a spiritual plane. We have to talk about, you know, just the war for your mind. And the very first line of defense is to be fearless.
Don't agree with you there, 100%.
So anybody else want to pipe in? And JL, RS?
I would like to ask RS. RS contacted me just to give me some tips on how to pronounce some of these German names. I'm very grateful to RS's assistance there. But I think RS is living in Germany. As an English or British subject living in Germany, I would quite like
well, to... I know who that is now. I wasn't aware, but yes, I do know who that is now. Thank you.
Ah, I'd love to get, spider on the walls view of the maneuvering and the general feeling within Europe. And Germany is a key country. I'd be quite curious to hear about that.
Sorry, Darren, I just want to mention that RS has put a message on the group, said, wish I could talk, but I'd wake up my kids.
Oh, I see. whenever it's convenient again, RS would like to hear your point of view, some intel from Germany.
In 2 weeks, two Saturdays from now, you're going to be really tired of hearing me and Darren talk, but that's the way it is for the next month, and hopefully we'll have some volunteers after that. But we will be covering World War II, The Tide of Aggression, 1939 to 1941, and that is 2 weeks from today.
Huh. Looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it just like that.
Yeah. I actually have to think, we are reading it. How must it have been for Quigley to have written it? How long did it take? Was it 20 years?
I think I remember reading that, yes. I'm sure this was just a massive undertaking. And it took him 20 years, but don't forget, he would have had student, intern, volunteer, or low-paid, you know, help. He would have had plenty of assistance in doing this, and still.
Yeah, because in the meantime, he would have to be training the Bill Clintons of the world and explaining what their role would be as president and that kind of thing. So he definitely would have had co-writers, co-authors, and co-researchers, yeah. It makes perfect sense. I'm ready to retire. It's 22:11 at night. And
Let's let you go then, you and Andrea. Thank you so much for hosting this, Andrea, and taking care of the audio and all of the graphics. I just want to say this, that before you stop the recording, the graphics and the news links and all the things you supply is phenomenal. Much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you all. Thanks for listening.